is co-presented with the Cité des Hospitaliers en Transition and CKUT-FM.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is there?
Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What?
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's community news program, Off the Hour. Today is Friday, April the 8th. My name is Brian Jefferson, and I'll be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Kanyenkehaka, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
Tune in to CKUT 90.3 FM, Tuesdays, 3 p.m. to 5 p.m., for a special Black History Month edition of the Montreal Sessions. The month kicks off on February 1st with the best in reggae and soca with your hosts, Production Sounds and Soca Head. Week 2, February 8th, Wizzy Moonchaser, host of The Morning Detour, broadcast live from DG Kicks, a sneaker store in NDG. The final 2 weeks, 15th and 22nd, are hosted by Stephen Ziplocks Hennessy, educator, creator,
and part of the Ill Groove Garden team. Don't miss it.
First, some news. The Black Coalition of Quebec Civil Rights Organization is filing an ethics complaint about a video of a police officer pushing a man to the ground in an alleyway in Chinatown. The police had been clearing people in the alleyway, and the witness told CBC that the victim had been sleeping in a makeshift shelter when the officer caused part of the shelter to collapse on him. And on Thursday morning, hundreds of SAGEP students at English colleges throughout Quebec left class to protest against Bill 96, which would require English SAGEP students to take more required French classes and an exit exam to graduate. And Montreal's recycling program is in a distressing state and is in need of change. Montreal's two recycling plants are in Lachine and Saint-Michel. They have both struggled with high contamination levels, which make it difficult to recycle the items. Contamination levels were recently around 25% at the two centers. Borough mayors have called for system changes. And on Monday, Premier François Legault and Mayor Valérie Plante announced that Quebec and Montreal are taking over the management of the REM de l'Est project. The 10 billion, 32-kilometer light rail project has faced much controversy over how it would affect eastern downtown Montreal. And Quebec's unemployment rate hit a historic low of 3.9% in April. That's 1.3 percent points lower than the national rate. The rate accounts for an increase in employment in professional, scientific, and technical services, offset by the declines in employment in construction and retail trade. Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5 p.m. My name is Brian Jefferson. Up first on this episode of Off the Hour, we'll be sharing the air with From Embers Podcast. We'll tune into an interview with Tawinike about her essay entitled Settlers on the Red Road, on Indigeneity, Appropriation, and Belonging. We'll bring you back at the top of the hour with some news that you can use. Right here on 90.3 FM.
You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade.
Nothing ever runs down by itself. Every fire needs a little
I am recording this intro here in rainy but still very beautiful rural Nova Scotia, and we're heading to the Halifax Anarchist Book Fair this Saturday, September 4th. If you're in the area and feeling ready, you should definitely check it out. It's all happening down at Grafton Street Park, located at 5381 Spring Garden Road. Our last episode, titled Coming Together Amid the Pandemic, featured an interview with two organizers from the Book Fair Collective. So you should check it out online at fromembers.libsyn.com. In our episode this week, I'm excited to share this interview with Tuinike about her zine released this spring, Settlers on the Red Road, on Indigeneity, Appropriation, and Belonging. The text addresses head-on the difficult and sometimes uncomfortable issue of race shifting in anarchist and anarchist-adjacent spaces, and in particular, the problem of unfounded claims by settlers to indigenous identity. Importantly, the author also directly critiques liberal identity politics and state-led reconciliation narratives for contributing to these dynamics, and locates it all within a larger structural project of colonization and erasure of indigenous people on Turtle Island. I think these discussions have been happening in indigenous communities and also radical spaces for years, quietly, but the recent revelations in the mainstream Canadian press raising questions about the identities of widely recognized and celebrated figures such as Joseph Boyden and Michelle Latimer have really brought the reality of this problem to the forefront of many mainstream conversations, and I'm really thankful that Tuinike took the time to map out an uncompromising critique of these dynamics and stake out a position from an anarchist perspective that really takes this much-needed conversation to the next level. The text also includes a helpful list of questions that can help someone explore either their own ancestry or empathetically question friends who are trying to figure out their own social position in this very messed up world. Tuinike's writing is available in the publications section on North Shore Counterinfo, which is at north-shore.info/publications.
Hi, my name is Tuinike. That's the name that I go by when I'm writing. I'm a midshift Cree woman of mixed European heritage. My dad's native and my mom is white. I identify as a half-breed quite proudly. I've written a couple of zines on state-led reconciliation and other topics. I'm a collective member of Epicona Distro, a project trying to spread ideas about Indigenous anarchism. I'm an anarchist and have been for about 8 or 10 years. The zine in particular that we're talking about today is my most recent, called Settlers on the Red Road. And it's about the phenomena of settlers, particularly settler anarchists, taking on an Indigenous identity based on distant ancestry or a family story, or maybe even nothing at all. It was a zine I wrote about 2 years ago, first stemming from a really hard conflict with a friend and comrade that I had. I was basically accused of weaponizing blood quantum against them and, you know, a lot of big words thrown around like lateral violence because I told them basically that I didn't recognize them as Native based on their discovery that a great-grandparent of theirs was Indigenous. I basically told them that that wasn't enough. The conflict was pretty intense, and I left or was pushed out of a lot of organizing spaces, mainly because kind of when I looked left and right, I realized that most of my mostly white settler anarchist comrades like didn't actually understand the conflict at all, and were pretty wary of the words blood quantum and lateral violence, and weren't sure that I wasn't doing something really shitty. And I got fielded a lot of questions like, well, you know, why are you Native if you're half, but she's not if she's an eighth, you know? And there was kind of just nowhere I could send them. I kept looking for zines that I could point them to, or things that other people had written. And I found a lot of things that were written by like more liberally people. And none of them really exactly fit the context. So, you know, that conflict dragged on for about 2 years. I wanted to write something about it, but I was kind of convinced to hold off as we tried to work through the conflict. We tried to work it out. It didn't work out. But over the 2 years, I was confronted with 3 other cases of radical community members in Southern Ontario, anarchist and like anarchist adjacent, that were found out to either be completely fabricating an Indigenous identity or basing it off an ancestry that was so distant, it just like didn't really make any sense. You know, and so I finally wrote this, and it was difficult to put out, but it was worth it. And it was kind of the Michelle Latimer scandal that when after that broke that I kind of realized I had to publish it. But it was actually very validating to see that kind of public reckoning. Like, a lot of Indigenous community was publishing kind of argument after argument in line with what I had been saying to my comrades, you know, that like kinship ties are more important than blood, that that's how Indigenous people define membership in a community, blah, 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 things like that. There was a lot of really great stuff written.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought up sort of how, when it came out, there has been this reckoning in the liberal media or whatever around race shifting that's happening. But it does tend to focus on kind of high profile academics and artists who are misrepresenting their identity to gain recognition or institutional power or funding that's been reserved for Indigenous people. But your focus was more on how this is playing out in radical communities and grassroots struggles. And I'm just wondering sort of how are the dynamics that you're, or I guess how are you framing the problem differently than what you refer to as like kind of these news articles that are talking about this money was supposed to go to an Indigenous person and it went to this other person instead or something like that.
Yeah, like the larger conversation, in the larger conversation, this is mostly focused on settlers getting money that's meant for Indigenous people, like getting like really high paid jobs or grants or things like that. And like that's a larger issue these days because of Trudeau policies of this like state-led reconciliation that I talk about, where tons of money is being allocated for Indigenous initiatives. And it's really tempting for settlers to want to grab that. We see this like right now, the tensions are really high with like in terms of like professors at universities being hired by mostly settler boards as Indigenous people without really understanding what that means or feeling like they should dig into it and actually find out if these people are Indigenous according to Indigenous standards of kinship. You know, and so there's a lot of like settlers getting hired into these positions. And then there's this reckoning that's happening about that right now. You know, and getting natives in universities is like a huge project of the state in the last 10 years. We've been convinced that kind of the way to help our communities is to go to university, become a social worker, you know, get inside the system, start working it, you know, indigenize. People love that word. And lots of Indigenous people see that state-led reconciliation effort and they want to believe that things are different and better, you know, but they're not. And we know that. I've said it kind of from the beginning that the official reconciliation government agenda is just another softer form of assimilation. But yeah, no, like as anarchists, we know that we aren't often dealing with large sums of money or paid positions, like sometimes, but not very often. But that's just such a narrow way to look at it, to be like, oh, this isn't damaging as long as settlers aren't getting money that's meant for Indigenous people. Like settlers claiming an Indigenous ancestry in anarchist community might be asked to speak on an issue at an event. They might get a seat in the car going to like ceremony or an action on the front line. They might get made a spokesperson for a campaign. But, you know, it's like more than that, too. Like Indigenous organizers, they're given a certain reverence. Their positions might be less questioned and their opinions more valued. People are like more likely to rally around their ideas and take risk to put them into action. And we can't really estimate or like underestimate the like pull of that kind of power. And it's that power that most concerns me. You know, as anarchists, we're meant to be against domination and hierarchy, but it's a real pull for someone that feels powerless to be able to claim an identity that's going to like make them feel important. And like I talk about this in the zine too, that it's not just like individuals who like f- that up. It's also like this kind of culture of identity politics that we sometimes adopt. But yeah, it's also true that these settlers claiming indigenous ancestry really f- up relationships with indigenous people and anarchists. Like, I truly think that anarchists share the closest vision of like a decolonial future with native people, but like native people want settlers to show up knowing just as firmly who they are and where they're from as we do, you know? And when people get found out to be making up or blowing up an indigenous identity, it creates like ripples of doubt in our relationship. Like, why was that person allowed to take on the identity for so long? And it also like creates doubt between native people, and it makes us more suspicious of each other. Like, that hurts Black natives, it hurts Mi'kmaq people, it hurts other non-status people with like an actual legitimate claim. Yeah, so you know, it's we have to look at this with a more nuanced lens.
Yeah, and you also make a pretty powerful argument that sort of links this phenomenon to. I think you called it a paradigm shift in Canadian colonialism. And I kind of want to unpack that a bit because it does seem pretty important. And this idea that, you know, the Canadian state is invested at this time in sort of blurring lines between settlers and Indians, as you say. It's a bold claim because I think a lot of people understand the history of Canadian colonialism as about being erasing Indigenous people, or you know, things like the Indian Act, which used these blood quantum formulas to like rapidly reduce the number of people who can claim Indian status in Canada. So I just want to kind of dig into that a little bit in terms of what do you think is changing under this era of state-led reconciliation. And what does it mean in terms of, yeah, in terms of this race shifting phenomenon?
So first of all, the Indian Act, residential schools, all those systems were created to like erase Indians from this landscape, because the end goal of colonization is always the removal of Indigenous people, so that settlers can take their place as like the rightful and only inhabitants of the land. Like, that's true. And any autonomous Indigenous presence makes that impossible, right? And so, like, they invented the idea of status just so they could take it away. And they took the kids away from their families so they never learned their customs. And then they made the customs illegal, you know, and took them away from the adults. And they destroyed their kinship ties, you know. But the fact of the matter is, like, it just didn't work. Like, we're still here. And as time went on, Canadians began to get less comfortable with the narrative that they were doing harm to Indigenous people. And like, we got louder and louder in the assertion that we were being harmed, and the state like still needed to get rid of Indians, but it just needed a new plan, you know? And so like, enter reconciliation. And multiculturalism like had a great framework already like in line for this. Indigenous people are now like celebrated as like a part of Canadian history. And it is a modern part of Canadian multiculturalism. And it's all very tricky, you know, but they're giving away a lot of money and attempting to uplift natives who play along. But there's no real move towards land return or autonomy, like not even close, you know. The secondary effect of this is that we're just like living in the first generation of Canadians who see claiming an Indigenous ancestry as something like not only honorable, but something that might actually like win you some privileges in society. You know, it might get you into that master's program you're eyeing. And like, indigeneity isn't like other racial categories because we base our belonging on kinship. Indians come in all colors. And so to really understand who's native and who isn't, it's not enough to just look at them. You got to like know where they come from and who their community is. You know, and settlers don't get that yet, I guess. And they've engaged in this process where like self-identification is enough. And you can now just declare yourself native. And, you know, while that might not work with other native people, it sure as hell works with settlers. You know, maybe another thing, like I don't really prescribe to academia that much, but something I have been like noticing a lot lately is a lot of talk about like they're apparently in the academic world, there's some like literature that talks like the different stages of colonialism, of settler colonialism. And the last stage of settler colonialism is basically becoming Indian, you know? So it's the settler self-indigenization. I would say it's pretty spot on to like a lot of what we're actually seeing right now, you know? So, you know, those theories and those thinkings might actually have some merit.
Yeah. And I think in trying to, discuss these often difficult to define boundaries, I guess, of identity, you sort of talk about blood quantum versus kinship. And I think this notion of kinship that you advance is a pretty powerful one and a good tool for sort of thinking through some of this stuff. And I was wondering if you could sort of lay out what you mean by kinship and how it applies to this.
So kinship is something I've been thinking a lot about. As I lay it out in my zine, kinship is the connection between you and other members of the community. It's made up of many parts. It's not just whether or not you've ever had an ancestor or relative who was born in that community, you know? So, like, finding a birth certificate isn't really enough. I lay out a bunch of questions in the scene that help, like, paint a picture of kinship, you know? And some of those are, like, do you or your family share a land base of that community? Do you share a language? Did you grow up close to the traditions of that community? How intertwined are the stories of your family and the stories of that community? You know, are your struggles connected? Like, do you share their struggle? Because, like, this isn't just a checklist where you can mark off, like, 6 of 10 boxes and say, okay, yes, I'm an Indian of that community. Everyone has a slightly different connection, and everyone has more or less claim to representing themselves as Indigenous or, like, as a member of a specific nation, especially your community. It's, like, nuanced, and, like, it has to remain nuanced. And so when someone claims to be Indigenous based on like a distant blood connection, they aren't honoring those systems of kinship that Indigenous people built and like maintained over thousands of years that like still exist and are like alive and thriving today, right? Like they're not plugging themselves into that. They're plugging themselves into something in the past, something like less tangible. They're using blood quantum. They are using blood quantum, you know, to insert themselves into a community they aren't really connected to. Blood quantum is the idea that, like, your genetics break down evenly throughout the generations and that having a certain percentage of blood makes you a certain percentage of a race or culture. Like, it's pseudoscience and it's racist. And, yeah, lots of times when folks insist that settlers claiming indigeneity prove kinship ties in addition to blood lineage, they're accused of using blood quantum, saying that, like, that they're being violent by saying they don't have enough native blood to disqualify their settler comrade. And that's pretty manipulative considering what's actually happening is the opposite. Upholding kinship is really, really important to decolonization. I've heard anarcho-commie bros discount kinship as though it's some sort of like Game of Thrones allegiance to your bloodline. Like, you know, we've had these like back alley conversations, people being like, oh, I don't want to like have to like align myself with my family. Like those aren't the people that like I want to like be in community with and like struggle with and you know what but it is that, and it's also so much more than that. You know, webs of kinship govern communities, you know, communities that actually stay in one place and are cohesive. You know, Indigenous communities were made up of families who were connected to other families, and those connections made up clans, which made up nations. And each of those levels of connection were important in the consensus-based governance systems that Native people had. Kinship is like the mapping out of who you're accountable to and who's accountable to you. And that's how communities made decisions that were best for everyone. So Canada, like the colonial state, like saw that kinship was the backbone of governance, and it sought out to destroy it. So like I said before, it broke up families, it took away kids, and then it imposed band council, right? Which is a system to replace the forms of that mutual accountability that Indigenous people had, because they knew that their forms of democracy, which were, you know, inherently based on like political affinity, just made us weaker, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I think the most some of the most difficult conversations that come up in your piece have to do with not people who are 100% lying about their past. I think that's easy to kind of condemn, but people who maybe lean into one ancestor, like you said, a few generations back or something like that. But of course, all this is interacting with Canadian colonial policies, which of course, you know, attempted to displace people from land, repress spiritual practices, repress language, and, you know, on a mass scale, physically remove children from communities through residential schools and children's aid societies in the 60s scoop, like you said. This is the kind of like the hard part for me is just sort of talking through how this applies to people who do have some history of having those kinship ties severed by the state.
Yeah, so this is really the hardest question in all of it, and it's the one people get the most tripped up on. Like, it's really scary to think of questioning your friend and finding out they actually have like a legitimate claim to an Indigenous community, and now like maybe they're gonna have hard feelings about you. But you know, the reality is discerning between someone who's like discovering their nativeness and someone who's reconnecting to it is not that hard. Like I said, identity is nuanced and it takes a good deal of honesty and hard work to like understand where we come from. But when someone's trying to figure out who they are and if they have an Indigenous community, it's like putting together pieces of a puzzle. They have to go and find the pieces one by one. And they do that by like talking to their relatives. They do that by finding out if there are people in that community that know their family. They do that by discovering like when their language was taken from them, all of these kinds of things, you know? And they also look at it, they also do it by like looking at their own life and asking themselves, like, do I have the experiences of an Indigenous person? And you know, like that puzzle is an ongoing project and like it has to be done carefully. You can't just try to force a piece where it doesn't belong. And when you have a picture of what your connection is, you have to represent it honestly. You can't say that your dad was Indigenous if you discover that his grandma was a band member of a reserve. The hardest part of that is that sometimes you won't be invited into spaces and you won't be accepted as a community member by some Native people. And that sucks. And I get it, like, as a Métis woman, as like a half-breed person, like, that's happened to me, and, you know, it will continue to happen, and I have to just accept that because I'm not entitled to the acceptance of other Indigenous people. Like, I'm not entitled to their kinship. It's important to know where you stand, and it's important to only talk from where you stand.
I think there's another point you make in your piece or an assertion that you think it is important for settler anarchists to build connection to land as well, which some might actually say is controversial, and that it should be, quote, hard won and honest and novel, as opposed to appropriating traditions and identities from Indigenous people. And I just wanted to talk about that for a second too, because I agree with that. I just wonder if it's even possible to really do for people who are so thoroughly severed from their own ancestral traditions, like how that's going to happen without appropriating traditions elsewhere or romantically reproducing like a settler frontier homestead culture or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I love this question. I think about it a lot too, but I guess I didn't realize it was so controversial until recently. But yeah, like I actually feel like there's this false choice on the table between settlers reconnecting to their ancestral traditions, which is like, which in the case of like Europeans, I guess it's like European paganism, or appropriating Indigenous cultures here. Like neither of those really make sense. I've never been on the side of sending people back to Europe. I mean, at this point, there's so many people here from so many places, like sending settlers back doesn't really mean the same thing it would have meant 100 years ago. And like, it's also just logistically impossible, like, let's be honest. So, you know, if settlers are here to stay, which like, I assume they are, then what can be done about this connection to land thing, you know? And like, when I say connecting to land, I don't just mean like growing a garden or getting your hands dirty or whatever. I mean like actually embedding yourself in the web of relationships that make up life here. Like indigenous people are not just in kinship with each other. We're in kinship with the plants and the animals that live on this land. We're in kinship with the water and the winds. Like we're named after those things, you know? And like I said, kinship is about connection. Like indigenous people are connected to this land and to each other through the stories that we tell about it. Stories that are passed down generation to generation. Stories that lay out instructions as to how to live here and how to take care of this place. Stories that are told in a shared language that was developed in relationship with the land. You know, stories that describe ceremonies that we come back to year after year to honor the land and the water. It's like Native culture is inseparable from the land and inseparable from their nation's history with it. And if settlers are going to build their own like land-based relationships to this place, I don't believe that it can be won by learning and replicating the traditions of their ancestors, because those shared stories and customs were connected to a land base that's different than the one they're on. And the stories like that their ancestors would have told each other were based in a history that like didn't include sailing across the ocean and attempting to annihilate another people, right? And like the story of settlers here isn't the same story of indigenous people. Like it's very different. And so they have to tell a different story. And it's true that like, it's true, you know, if we're talking about like European traditions, like there are some plants here that were brought with settlers from Europe. You know, there was like a degree of terraforming that was accomplished. And I think I see some white herbalists like trying to connect to their ancestries through their plants. And I think that's cool. But like the truth is, if settlers are going to find a connection to this land, it's going to have to be by co-creating an origin story that's fair and accurate and based in justice. Like a story that will place them here and show them what their responsibilities are to this land and the other beings living here. And it's going to have to be like old and new. You know, it's like both things. And, you know, I think anarchism can be like a guiding force in that, like a bedrock of principles around which to start telling stories about how settlers want to relate to this land, you know? I think that there's something there to offer.
Yeah, I actually strongly agree with what you just said. And I think that, you know, I think it there are a lot of pitfalls in the creations of those stories, but it doesn't mean that it's not an important process to take on, knowing that there's going to be mistakes and screw-ups along the way. And, yeah, and like, I think there are, I like that you brought up whether, you know, anarchism can be like an identity or a kinship tie that can be meaningful and relevant as well. Or I think about, you know, other people who have in queer communities or with chosen families of various kinds, like have constructed kinship in other ways that can sort of embody different social relations to each other and to the land. And I think it's, you know, I just think it's important, like you said, like to not blur things or kind of misrepresent things. And, you know, I think maybe sometimes the anarchist version of this is like when people say, well, indigenous people didn't have any private property or whatever, which is true, but it doesn't mean that, you know, there's no claim to land or that everyone has the same relationship to land or that you don't have to, you know, consider your social position in colonialism anymore just by acknowledging that fact or something like that. So I think that's just something to guard against. Cause it is so, like you said, it's so enticing to kind of, I think it's called, settler moves to innocence, in that, decolonization is not a metaphor, piece that you reference in your zine. Yeah, there is so much desire to do that among people who are trying to imagine other ways of living and be in solidarity with struggles for land.
100%. And maybe I actually want to clarify something about anarchism and kinship. And, you know, maybe this is my most controversial take yet. But I don't believe that anarchism is enough to hold a community together. Like, maybe I actually thought that at one point, but I don't anymore. And I actually don't think political affinity or political commitments are good enough, like, for creating shared values and governing how we act collectively and, like, how we solve problems. Like, like they can do all of those things, but they can't, it's not what keeps us together. You know, I see anarchist community, like I live in it. I'm an urban indigenous person living my daily life with other anarchists. And I see the ways in which our politics can be fickle and the transience, which is like an ever-present reality, especially in the city. And I've been in conversation after conversation about building a commitment to each other and creating something more like family. But I think we're too often missing the point. Like, we aren't seeing the reality in front of us, which is that kinship isn't just about shared values. It's about being committed to a place, because your identity is connected to that place, you know, the land and the other people there. It's about birthing and living and dying together. It's about doing life shit, you know? You can up and leave and do anarchy somewhere else, like move to Montreal or Europe, you know? But you know what keeps people in one place and one community? Like wanting to watch your friends' kids grow up and not wanting to pull your kids away from the people who help raise them, you know? Like I don't want a community of people chasing some pure form of anarchism. The reality is, like, in a post-revolution or like post-collapse future, I generally lean towards the second, kinship will emerge on its own. Like, when we're engaged in a process of working together to meet our collective needs, we become invested in place, you know? And when we become invested in place over years and years, like, people have kids and those kids grow up and become a part of your community, and then they take care of you, and you have a vested interest in passing down what you know to keep the anarchy that you love alive. And so intergenerational communities would just happen, you know? And if they didn't happen, then your community would be dead within 40 or 50 years, right? And so I've heard so many of my friends casually or vindictively say, like, having kids is counter-revolutionary, or like, when you become a parent, you stop being an anarchist. And I think, like, what fucking revolution are you fighting for? Like, I think that a movement that excludes mothers and children is counter-revolutionary. Like, that's fighting for a dead community. And it's so completely counter to, like, every teaching I've ever received from my Indigenous kin. Children are at the blockade and they're at ceremony because they have to hear those stories over and over again. And because if the children weren't there, then the mothers couldn't be there. And it's so important to have the perspective of parents when making decisions about the future. And I just think that sometimes, like, yeah, like, okay. And, like, let me be real. Like, sometimes people become parents and they take on this politic that, like, mothering is, like, the most revolutionary act or something like that. And, like, that's not what I'm advocating for. I don't think it's more or less revolutionary than burning banks. I'm not saying that everyone should have kids. And I don't believe you should have kids because you think you're, like, raising the next generation of radicals or something like that, because you just never know who your kids are going to grow up to be. But anarchists need to make space for parents to be anarchists and for kids to be kids and for people to live whole and human lives within anarchy. And, like, maybe this is all just a tangent. It's probably the beginning of another zine at this point.
White gold, grandfather's sky, this getting old. Tides come and go when the river's froze, and the weatherman said it's getting cold. Winter's coming, I'm coming home. My ancestors come from the snow. I'm the firstborn and creating O's. Don't let me get in my zone. S on my chest, I'm the hero, I guess. Beads on my neck and my earlobes are stretched. Abnormal or regular, so unconventional. Are we original?
Yes.
Phone on, I got a bone to pick. I got trust issues I can never fix. I'm true to myself and my promise. And when I'm in Rome, I do the opposite. Got my voice back with my artifacts. Now I'm talking shit with my talking stick. From pop-notch bands on our own land, where illegal pot was provocative. We drumming our drums as usual. We singing our songs as suitable. We dance to it all so movable. We do it together, it's beautiful. I'm breathing heavy, I love it. My palms are sweaty, I love it. My culture's alive, I love it. The art is revived, I love it.
Lit like my my saint, homie, I ain't alone. The spirit stay with me to get where I'm going. How my first sweat, homie, I was reborn. Pride gets bigger as my hair gets long. Two long braids, that's a dedication. Son of a gun, no registration. Just like my pops. We about to feast, potlatch. Copper shield on fleek, top notch. Stay true from the jump, crisscross. The eternal island, it's the renaissance. Don't take my kindness for weakness, man. That shit too funny, my Nietzsche. So tell me, have you ever been at the bottom? It's muddy, my Nietzsche. I'm pissed off for greatness, my Nietzsche. Been silent and deadly since my nose was snotty. Besides all my fam, I don't fuck with nobody. Illuminative, no Illuminati. Illuminative, no Illuminati. Yeah! Misunderstood.
Misunderstood.
I don't understand.
I'm a red man.
With a method man.
Resist,
revive, indigenize. We heavy hitters. We don't die, we multiply.
Cry me a river.
You're listening to From Embers, a weekly anarchist radio show and podcast. We broadcast every Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. You can find all of our original content at fromembers.libsyn.com or by searching From Embers in your preferred podcast app. We're halfway through a discussion with Tuwinike, who wrote the essay Settlers on the Red Road on Indigenous Identity, Appropriation, and Belonging, which deals with the difficult and sometimes uncomfortable issue of race shifting in anarchist and anarchist-adjacent spaces, and in particular the problem of unfounded claims by settlers to Indigenous identity. Tuwinike's writing is available in the publication section on North Shore Counterinfo at north-shore.info/publications. You also talk about sort of solidarity and how the embrace or whatever of liberal identity politics has sort of somewhat incentivized these kinds of misrepresentations that people sometimes make because of a model of allyship where non-Indigenous people kind of give up their agency to capital I Indigenous people, and like, you know, I think you call it a culture of obedience to Indigenous people as a strategy. So what is the model of solidarity that you would advance instead that you think is more meaningful than that?
I think solidarity. Well, I think settlers need to figure out how they relate to this land and their place in it. I think I'm often a bit of a separatist, and I think sometimes that actually surprises people. I don't actually think that after like the crumbling of Canada, the Indigenous people and settlers should form communities together. I don't know that, like, I don't know very many Indigenous people who even want that. I think Indigenous people deserve land and autonomy and freedom from settler interference to rebuild and strengthen their own communities. And I think that time should also be spent by settlers to determine how they want to be here and how they want their community to be in relationship with Indigenous communities that they're going to live close to. And I just don't think that there could ever be good relations if those settler communities weren't based in some sort of connection to land and like an anarchist ethic of non-domination. So like, I think when settlers engage in solidarity work with Indigenous people, it should always be with this in mind. It should never be done with some secret or not so secret desire to join that community. I believe in solidarity in like the truest sense of the word, which means like you and your community are acting in concert with another because you see a shared goal that could be betterment with cooperation. But like, that means you go your separate ways afterwards. You're pursuing your own paths, right? They just became parallel for a minute. Like, it's not a joining together of two communities permanently. So I think settlers need their own project. And part of that project needs to be supporting Indigenous liberation and land return. And another part of it needs to be figuring out how they want to live together and structure their communities. And I don't think they get to have, like, well, like, I don't, yeah, okay. I don't think that they need an Indigenous stamp of approval on their plan. Like, I think they should just figure out a way to be good neighbors in a relationship that supports the success of Indigenous recovery and resurgence, you know? And they should keep their other shitty settler neighbors in check so it's not Indigenous people's problems.
I don't want to forget about the fact that aside from the analysis in the zine, there's also a pretty practical sort of tool that is for people who want to have conversations with friends and comrades to sort of ask them about their indigeneity or not indigeneity. And it did strike me as an interesting overlap with like some of the discussions around security culture that I've seen going around in the last 10 years. Like, and I think you called it like Western politeness or this kind of like social norm that's against prying into other people and how people need to get past that. And I think that that's an important point for both security culture and sort of guarding against infiltration, as well as sort of holding each other accountable to our identity claims.
Totally. Yeah, it's very important to know who you're working with. And in our kind of like urban, atomized existences, we find each other as individuals, right? We rarely grew up together. We don't know each other's families. We might get to know each other's families like over time, but this means like there's a lot of work to do actually to build trust, let alone lasting bonds, and even just like a deep understanding of who someone is as a person. You know, as anarchists, we don't exist in a web of kinship, and we're not accountable to each other in many real ways. And we are like vaguely accountable to our politics, but not even so much that we can hold each other to them in like a meaningful way. And this is really different, right? When you go into Indigenous communities, like who are engaged in struggle, like you realize that like all those people grew up together in some way or another. Like they either dated or, you know, they dated each other's cousins, or like they hated each other in high school, or they've been best friends since they were seven. Like, you know, it's very different. So like, yeah, we have to get to know each other, and identities are the ways that we define our experiences and make ourselves more legible to each other. But identities are like the ones that are self-proclaimed, you know, these like self-identifications need to be examined, because our commitment to like uplifting those that capitalism keeps down, you know, like we have a commitment to that. It's like our own version of equity, right? Like we try to like uplift those voices of people that don't have a voice in wider society. But like that means that like within our smaller community, it comes with like a kind of power, and we need to be able to stop people from seeking that power. So yeah, like we need to create a culture in which it's okay to ask someone where they came from and who their family is and what makes them Indigenous, even if you're a white person. And like I've not yet heard of any infiltration happening based on a claimed indigeneity, but like we know that during G20, one of the undercover cops like repeatedly used claims of racism to stop further questions about who he was, right? Or just like generally create drama and like confusion. And that would be a very successful tactic. You know, so like if someone doesn't want to use their real name in organizing, that's one thing, but if they won't let you go to their house, that's another. You know, we need to know who we're acting with. We need to know what their motivations are. So I laid out questions in the zine to help lead a discussion with a friend where you can try to figure that out, or like help them figure out whether or not they should call themselves Indigenous, because I think it's important. And I think that if you as a settler support their claim to indigeneity without examining it, and not just examining it based on like, you know, like a white or like a settler idea of what makes somebody Indigenous, but like, does it stand up to Indigenous definitions of kinship, right? Like if you don't actually like do that work, then like you're taking on responsibility for their claim, and like it's eventually going to blow up, and it's probably Indigenous folks that are going to figure it out and be pissed about it. And so, like, it's worth it for you to do that. And, like, I kind of wish that other people in my community had done that, you know? I wish it hadn't, like, fallen on me in the end. And, you know, I also wish that I had done it sooner. Like, I had opportunities to do it sooner, you know, and I didn't do it. You know, but, like, I can't guarantee you that conversation is going to go well. And I can't guarantee you won't lose a friend because I did, you know. Like, someone who's really invested in their claim, they're going to find ways to defend it to the very end, including attacking you for asking questions.
Sure. But, I mean, the questions that you lay out are, I would call them empathetic. Like, they're not, it's not an interrogation room. It's like a, it's like you're helping your friend figure this thing out.
Yeah, and those questions were written out in that zine very thoughtfully and with 2 years of thought put into it. I wish I had actually done this with my comrade when I had the chance, like this, like what I actually wrote in the zine, but like I didn't. And when I did finally try to assert like my opinion and my position on their claim, like the conversation didn't go like that. It was really messy and I did lose a friend in that. And yeah, I guess I just hope that this resource will prevent that from happening and kind of stop this phenomena from continuing in our community.
I was wondering about like what you think, how you think that conversation goes differently if you're not talking to a friend, but you're talking to an acquaintance in a coalition or something that's a little bit more distance where there's a little bit less of an expectation of accountability or something like. Because in my experience, that's been the sort of level of proximity where the questions have come up the most and seem the hardest to kind of raise, because it's like someone can just walk away from that relationship, you know, at the first sign of trouble.
I think you should reach out to the people who are close to that person. Ask them first, like, what they know about their friend's claim to being Native. The chances are... There are people around them who feel just as weird and unsure about supporting them as you do, but they don't feel like they have the right to say anything because they're a settler or they don't understand the issue, you know? So make a plan with them. Maybe give them the zine. Honestly, give them the zine. If you don't find that, if you don't find people that are like wary of the claim, like I'd still encourage you to approach them. Tell them like you've had bad experiences in the past and you're trying to be responsible to Indigenous community by ensuring that you're uplifting the voices of people who can represent Native people, right? Like, say like, hey, I'm just coming to talk to you. I'm not trying to offend you, but I'm just like really invested in trying to make sure that I'm honoring kinship. And like, I've had some shitty experiences and I just want to like check in with you to like know a bit more about you and like where you came from and what's going on. You know, maybe they do walk away. Maybe they tell you their ancestry is private and you're being violent. That kind of reaction should be a big red flag. And you get to choose who you organize with and who you don't. You know, feeling pressure to support every Indigenous person or every person who claims to be Indigenous just because you're a settler. Like, that's liberal identity politics, and that's what I was talking about earlier.
I'm thinking, like, I was moved by your point that, like, people not saying anything is sort of enabling this behavior, and also, like, it always blows up eventually, and it's going to blow up a lot worse in, like, 10 years if you don't deal with it as soon as it comes up, kind of thing. And I've definitely been guilty of kind of, like, just kind of feeling sketchy about somebody that I'm not actually friends with and just kind of, like, you know, kind of being like, I'm going to keep that person at a distance. I don't really trust them, but I'm not going to confront them either. But I think, you know, almost regardless of what the reason is for that, I think in a lot of cases, you know, you end up feeling bad because it's like this kind of blows up in some way, somehow down the road. And you're like, oh, maybe I should have actually kind of had the courage to do something about this as soon as I noticed it.
Yeah, I mean, what I can say to that is that every single instance of a settler claiming indigeneity illegitimately that I've come across, there were always people around them who said they wished that they asked more questions. And yeah, in the end, it was always left to Native folks to actually confront the person and deal with that baggage.
Especially in situations where it's kind of like a shield against toxic behavior or something like that. Like, Anyways, I've taken a lot of your time, and I told you it'd be an hour, and it's been like an hour and a half, so sorry about that.
Absolutely not. I love the conversation, and I love Remembers, so thanks so much, Marcy, for letting me on the show.
That's it for this episode of From Embers, a weekly anarchist radio show and podcast. That interview was with Tewinike, who wrote the essay Settlers on the Red Road on Indigenous Identity, Appropriation, and Belonging, which deals with the difficult and sometimes uncomfortable issue of race shifting in anarchist and anarchist-adjacent spaces, and in particular, the problem of unfounded claims by settlers to Indigenous identity. Tewinike's writing is available in the publications section on North Shore Counterinfo at north-shore.info/publications. We broadcast every Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. You can find all of our original content at fromembers.libsyn.com or by searching From Embers in your preferred podcast app. As always, we welcome any feedback that you have, so do get in touch with us at fromembers@riseup.net, and we will see you next week.
Rocks on my feet as I walk through the street, trying to feel the footprints of my forefathers. With my city on my back and my reservoir on the map, we need more water, more life, more copper. Knees weak, but I'm walking with my chest out. Chin up to the sky like I got a headdress on. Head up in the clouds and I'm feeling we the best out. Three albums in and it's coming to the rest now. Hey yo, let me clear my head for a sec. Yeah, yeah. Let me think about some shit I wouldn't think about. I love holding all my people up. Let me feel myself for a minute. Long hair, red skin, face tats represent. Don't love us like you say you do. What's love without trust?
What's love without trust?
Hell no, I don't trust you. Lately I've been feeling more alive when I write. Love connected to my spirit, that's what Bo must have felt like. Vision in his head, see the block in his hand. All I love is my people, my culture, my land. Goddamn, I gotta love me, don't hold that above me. Me, myself, and I in good company. I lost people on my journey, but I found my identity. There's nothing in my will, but I leave it with this legacy. Ooh. I'm feeling like a motherfucking legend. Feeling like myself more than ever. These stories live forever, they're genetic. It's really up to you how you tell it. You gon' learn today. When the man comes around in that all black denim, Dre beats on his head, ain't nothing you can tell him. I've been feeling like a motherfucking legend.
It's been a long time coming for a younger from around the way.
From around the way.
He couldn't love himself till his hair got long and became a brave.
He became a brave.
And nothing was the same.
Nothing was the same.
Have you seen a legend in your lifetime?
Oh my.
Well, alright.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Hey. Picture me rocking deer high. My spirit being a giant like Andre and Eli. Underlay, Richie, E.I. Urban legend in this bitch. I feel like T.I., T.I. Uh-oh. All my ride or die steady bona fide. Woo. What we call M-I-N-A-Y. Woo. Young D for decolonize. So revitalize of young tribes. Christopher Wallace. Over Columbus. My clan bring the ruckus like Wu-Tang. Want my hair low, let my nuts hang.
Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to an episode from August 31st, 2021, created by From Embers Podcast. If you want to hear the rest of the show, you can head to channelzeronetwork.com. And before we go, here's some news that you can use. Thursday, May 5th was the National Day of Awareness and Mourning for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives. The day honored the thousands of Indigenous relatives who are missing and murdered each year across Turtle Island. Visit mmiwhoismissing.org to find out how to support the families of these Indigenous relatives. And The Open Door is urgently calling for clothing donations. Socks, towels, shoes, underwear, and any other clothing can be dropped off at 3535 Avenue du Parc. Please ensure all clothing items are lightly used, washed, and folded. And McGill Students for Science-Based Addiction Treatment is holding interviews starting tomorrow for their executive committee. They are seeking out individuals who are passionate, forward-thinking student leaders who care about addiction. You can find the position descriptions and application form in their Instagram bio at McGillSSAT. And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Kate Addison, Joel Salmadal, Killian Davenport Brown, Elsie Yang, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041 extension 7000, or newsintern at ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Instagram at Off the Hour, or connect with us on Facebook. Search for us on CKUT. Stay tuned for a cafe coming up next, right here on CKUT.
Listening to CKUT in Montreal!
Around the mountain, hold tight, shut your eyes. Girl, you set me up for Zion.